Good morning, Your Honors. Opposing counsel, may it please the court, John Schonkweiler for the plaintiff and appellant Patrick Halperin, and with me is my partner Adam Wiskowski. This case went to a jury trial on one count, the breach of fiduciary duty against the defendant Thomas Halperin. The claim concerned arbitrary and excessive compensation that Thomas paid to himself and two other officers at Commercial Light without the approval of any independent director, and that he kept secret by lying to the company's auditors. At the conclusion of the trial, the jury found that Thomas did breach his fiduciary duties to Patrick, but also found that the claim was barred by the statute of limitations, and judgment was entered for Thomas on the verdict. There is no dispute that Patrick filed suit 5 years after the events in question, so the issue was when Patrick discovered or should have discovered the breach of fiduciary duty. In that regard,
I want to stop you because we really know all that. I want to ask you what it is about in the instructions, your proposed language, that you think would have made a difference to the jury's deliberations. Because everyone agreed, I think, that Thomas had a duty to disclose what the executives of the company were being paid. And your proposed language about the extent of Patrick's claim seems quite vague to me. What concept were you trying to convey to the jury? A specific dollar amount that Thomas was overpaid?
No, Your Honor. I don't think there's one set of exact language that captures that. I think you could say it is the existence of the claim, the extent of the claim. It was argued by Mr. Macy orally to the court in the jury instruction conference. We used the language straight from the Wisniewski case, which is the existence of the claim. But the gist of it is, and this is from two Illinois Supreme Court cases, I'm reading from DeLuna, citing Kenroy, a fiduciary who is silent and thus fails to fulfill his duty to disclose material facts concerning the existence of a cause of action is fraudulently concealed. And the gist of that, and what it means, is that the plaintiff, in a situation where you have a fiduciary relationship, doesn't need to ask a question, can remain silent, can say nothing, can ask nothing, unless and until the fiduciary satisfies his duty to disclose the facts concerning the existence of the case, to disclose the wrongdoing. Now, that doesn't mean that he had to tell Patrick, here's what your legal theory is, here are what your damages are. If that's what you're asking, certainly not. But he had to disclose, under the Supreme Court precedent, the facts concerning the existence of the case, the facts that give rise to the case, the existence of the wrongdoing that underlied the cause of action. And he didn't do that. And the instruction doesn't say that. There is no way the jury could have decided that issue because it wasn't put to him. And that's fundamentally the problem we have with the instruction. As this court's Aliotta and Wilson cases establish, the reality is you can't go back and know what a jury would have done if they were given a different instruction.
But didn't this instruction that the court gave, fiduciary duty to disclose material facts, didn't that give you room to introduce all the evidence that you had that he concealed this wrongdoing?
It did, Your Honor.
Because they're all those facts would be material.
It did, Your Honor.
So why would you be hurt by that instruction?
The harm is this. The question put to the jury, the question the jury had to determine, whether Patrick should have discovered his cause of action and when. Okay. It was framed like this by the parties. Thomas says he didn't ask for anything. He didn't ask for information. He didn't ask
for
coordination.
All you have to say is that obviously these were material facts, how the income is divided up among the three owners, right? That's material.
They're material. They're material to his cause of action. The jury wasn't allowed to decide that. They have to apply this jury instruction, Judge, as written. And the words of the instruction that were given, first of all, they don't come from any case law. There is none to support them. And they don't mean the same thing.
I don't understand. So first it says, Thomas owed Patrick a fiduciary duty to disclose material fact. And then it says, for this reason, any failure by Thomas to disclose facts that he was under duty to disclose amounts to concealment. And Patrick wasn't required to scrutinize Thomas for misconduct. So why wouldn't the material facts that Thomas was under a duty to disclose included the facts about his compensation, and his failure to disclose them would then amount to concealment? I can see why the judge might be uncomfortable with your proposed instruction, which says disclose all material facts concerning the extent of Patrick's claim. That makes it sound as if he's presumed to know the claim and somehow, right? I don't know, it's a little, maybe neither is ideal, but it just seems the important thing for instructions is what it allows the lawyers to argue and, you know, allows what evidence presents. And I don't see why the district court's instruction didn't give you enough room for that.
It gave us room to put in the evidence, but what we couldn't do is we couldn't argue to the jury that Thomas's duty to disclose, which meant everything here. Thomas's duty to disclose, which meant everything in the end, because the rest of the instruction that is correct and nobody is objecting to says if Thomas doesn't satisfy that duty to disclose, if he doesn't disclose a fact that he is under a duty to disclose, that equals fraudulent concealment, and the statute does not run. So the case turned on that one thing. And what we couldn't argue...
Yeah, but you have all material facts in your instructions. Is that...
No, Your Honor.
Your proposed...
Oh, I'm sorry, in our instruction.
You disclose all material facts, is what you say.
Concerning the existence of the claim...
The existence of the claim. I want to follow up on what Judge Posner said. But the suggestion that in the given instruction to disclose all material facts concerning the operation and management of the commercial light to a lay juror, wouldn't that be even more specific as to the responsibility of the defendants?
No, Judge, respectfully, I disagree. The instruction as written, which doesn't have the word all in it, but in all events, refers to material facts relating to operation and management of a company.
Well, what else is there except the operation and management of the company, which would underline which would be the basis of whatever the claim is?
Well, for starters, it doesn't say all or even the material.
Well, when it says material, all may be redundant.
Oh, I'm not so sure. The absence of an article.
But I'll give you the all. I'm just saying, isn't it more demanding for the juror's focus to speak to material facts concerning the operation and management of commercial light than the claim against him? In other words, to a lay juror who's been told to focus on the complete operation and management of the company, I just am at a loss to understand how that wouldn't be actually in aid of your argument.
Well, let me give two answers to that. The first is that I don't think a jury could be expected to understand this language, material facts concerning the operation and management of the company. I don't think they could possibly understand that to
mean
every...
But you have material facts in your...
Yeah, you use the same language.
Phrase. Here's the difference. Why is it prejudicial? It's too general. It's too vague. It allows the jury to conclude that Thomas did disclose facts concerning the operation and management of the company, which he did.
These minutiae of jury instruction, that's not what drives the result in a trial. I notice you don't argue that the jury, you don't argue that you should have won on the merits, right?
That's right. Given the instruction we
had. I think you had a strong case, which is certainly not negated by the instruction that the judge gave.
Respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor. The instruction...
No, that's not realistic. That's just not realistic. Think jurors can parse these instructions and create, you know, enormously elaborate grammatical, linguistic structures and then apply them? No, it gives a mood. And I think the chief significance of instructions, it sets the boundaries to the closing argument. So, and I think this judge's instruction, not perfect, But it gave you everything you needed to tell the jury about this, you know, huge. Now, of course, the evidence really isn't conclusive in your favor, right?
Well, given the correct instruction, we think it is.
Why? Why is that? How do we know that he overpaid himself?
Well, it's not just the case about overpayment. The claims.
Well, if it's not about overpayment, who cares?
The damages flow from the overpayment. But
yes, that's good. But so the case is about overpayment. Because what you want is money, right?
This part is true. The case is about far more because it's
no, it's not about far more. It's about money. It's about overpayment. If he didn't overpay himself, if he was paying himself and his senior employees, what was this is a large successful company until it ran into the ground. So maybe he was paying salaries to himself and the others that were comparable to other firms of that size and profitability.
Correct. If the payments were in line with what they should have been, there wouldn't have been a case. Absolutely correct. The difference is, if the jury had been instructed that the facts that are disclosed by Thomas, the facts that he must...
I don't understand. If you could convince the jury that these people, that he cheated his brother out of all this money by overpaying himself, do you really think the judge's instruction would prevent the jury from delivering a verdict in your favor?
I do, Judge, and here's why. If the jury, the instruction they're given, allows the duty to be satisfied by the disclosure of facts relating to the company, even if they don't relate to the claim. The evidence showed that Thomas's vice president, new vice president in 93, pushed him to pay unprecedented bonuses. He paid himself the same, and then he paid Sorden, who was the only other person in the business who knew these checks were being written because he was writing them, falsified board minutes to make it appear the board had approved these payments. And in fact, at the same time, he was fastidiously concealing them from the only independent director in the company and lying to his auditors who insisted.
And you say that a jury couldn't render a verdict on those facts for your client without violating the judge's instruction?
The question,
respectfully. No, answer my question, yes or no.
And the question is whether they could have?
Yeah.
That's not the question. That's
Look,
not the standard.
I asked you a question. I'm not interested in your arguing with me about my question.
I beg your pardon.
I asked you whether, on the facts you just recited, the jury would be precluded by the judge's instructions from returning a verdict in your favor.
Precluded?
Oh, I give up. You don't want to answer my question.
Well, it's a tough question.
I'll answer myself.
It's a tough question I've never considered.
I'm very interested. Were there any executive officers besides Thomas, Sorden, and Morris?
There were other officers. I don't know, and there was no evidence in the record as to who is considered an executive or who isn't, or as to whose salary was listed as an executive salary in any financial statement.
Okay, thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Bargiel?
Thank you.
Morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name again is Paul Bargiel, and along with Michael Morrisrow, who represented the defendants at trial, I represent Thomas Halperin.
Were Thomas, Sorden, and Morris the only three executive officers?
They're the only ones that were mentioned in the complaint. As far, is that true, Michael? I guess the answer is yes.
Because what I've been trying to figure out was whether the timeline for executive compensation would be enough to put Patrick on notice.
Well,
of a potential problem with that.
Well, I think the answer to that is, well, I think there are two points that I would like to make, and then I'll sit down because I think that this has been explored in the briefs and here today. One is, counsel said, I believe that if the salaries were in line, you know, and bonuses were in line, there'd be no problem here, independent of the jury instruction. If you take a look at the record in this case, there is no evidence to indicate whether or not the salaries were commensurate with what other people were receiving, whether they were excessive or not. That's just an assumption that counsel has gone on, because no one ever testified.
Well, 200 to 300% increases in compensation.
Yeah, that's what he says.
From year to year is, that's, wow.
It's a lot of money. But anyhow, but there is no evidence with regard to that. However, with regard to the jury instruction, which is why we're here today, the claim that was made in this case by the plaintiff is that my client paid himself and other executives excessive compensation. That was the claim. Okay, the jury instruction that was given was, under the law, Thomas and Patrick is a commercial light stockholder. Thomas owed Patrick as a commercial light stockholder a fiduciary duty to disclose material facts concerning the operation and management of commercial light. Now, the financial statements and documents which were made by commercial light were certainly part of the material facts concerning the operation and management of the company. Those financial statements, which included the compensation every year of Thomas and the other stockholders, were provided to Patrick on an annual basis. As a matter of fact, he admitted in the record that he had received these statements. They showed what the compensation was that my client and the others received.
Did they show the yearly change? You mentioned it.
Well, from 1 year to the next, I mean...
You just looked at the two figures.
Right.
One was three times.
Right, that is correct, Your Honor. So the point being is that the jury, clearly, if they followed the instruction, which presumably they did, they had the material facts concerning the plaintiff's claim against the defendant, my client. Those material facts included the actual compensation that was paid. There was no surprise about that. He got that every year. That, I think, is the reason behind the jury's conclusion that the statute of limitations applied in this particular case, because Patrick, who was the plaintiff in this case, every year received these financial statements, which included the compensation which was given to Thomas, my client, and the other officers. That, I think, and since we're only here for the jury instruction, that, I think, indicates or demonstrates that the jury instruction in this case did not mislead the jury. It wasn't any kind of problem. And I think, to Your Honor's comment, too, I think the jury instruction that was actually given is probably more inclusive than the one that they proposed. So I don't think that they have any complaint here or any kind of case at all. And I certainly can't meet the standard, I think, that they're required to, considering all the instructions, the evidence, and the arguments, that it appears that the jury was misled or that their understanding of the case was seriously affected to the prejudice of the plaintiff in this case.
How much was Patrick getting every year?
Let me see. He was getting. I know. Let me see. I don't know exactly what the numbers were, but he received a regular paycheck. He also received health benefits from Commercial Light. He participated in the company's 401k plan and its deferred compensation plan.
Was his income from the company also be on the annual financial statement?
My answer to that is, I believe so. I don't know that it would be in the executive salary, because I don't believe that he would have been.
These were dividends that he was receiving.
I think they were in the form of salary, because his brother, who is also a witness in the case, Daniel, he testified that he was paid between $50,000 and $90,000 annually, and sometimes as much as $120,000. And then he was never involved in the day-to-day operation, like Patrick was not involved. And that when he sold his stock, which was later than Patrick, he got $2.4 million, whereas Patrick only got $1.2 million. So it's my impression from reading the record that they were both.
And refresh my memory, what was Thomas making a year?
A lot of money.
No, no. I'm serious. How much?
I think down at the end, several hundred thousand dollars and a million. In that regard, though, too, I mean, to compare the two is...
How much?
Several hundred thousand dollars to... I mean, we're talking over a period of 5 years to over $1 million. But my point, too, with regard to that is that these are truly apples and oranges. The other two guys, the other two brothers, didn't do anything. All they did was collect money all along. Thomas, my client, was the guy who was responsible for running the company.
And into the ground.
I'm sorry?
Into the ground.
Well, that's where it wound up. Whether it was him or other circumstances, a little bit difficult to tell, I think.
What's
I mean,
nature,
I'm sure market circumstances had something to do with
that. What was the nature of the
that.
Company?
What?
What's the electrical. Business of the company?
Contract. It's electrical contract.
Yeah, I understand.
Yeah, they. I think they started putting up street lamps with light bulbs back in the day. I think it was on for over 100 years.
Yeah, okay.
And, but they got stuff. To be very big time.
Yes, they did.
Contract.
Yeah. That is correct, Your Honor.
And then it collapsed.
But I would suggest again in closing that what we're here to determine, I think their appeal is about the jury instruction. And once again, I think the jury instruction, counsel, I think, has failed to make an argument that satisfies the...
Now, were they the only owners or were other family involved?
Yes. I think originally it was the father. The brothers... their mother was involved in this at some point in time too. Then the brothers owned it with Thomas as the one who was going to operate the company.
Now, did Daniel bring a suit or?
Yeah, he did.
He sued too.
But it's not part of this.
Not part.
No. Yeah.
Okay.
So anyhow, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
I would ask that you affirm the judgment of the lower court.
Thank you. So, Mr. Shankwal, your time expired, but you can have another minute if you'd like.
Your Honor, to answer your question you asked before, was the jury precluded from entering a judgment in our favor given the instructions? Probably not precluded, but the test is, was it a confusing or misleading instruction that prejudiced us? And the inquiry there is, could it have come out differently? And the reason that has to be the inquiry is because all you can do as an aliota is look at what was said, look at the facts that are in the record, and conclude, okay, first, could a jury have reached the conclusion they did by applying the law that was erroneous?
Well, what about Mr. Bargiel's point that your evidence was primarily about this very rapid increase in Thomas Halpern's income rather than comparing his income with that of comparable executives in comparable companies?
And the question is whether that was disclosed adequately in the financial statements.
No, was the primary evidence? No, I'm talking about the underlying merits of your case against him. Whether there was evidence comparing his income to that of other people running similar companies, there not necessarily there. Similar in doing electrical contracting, but similar in size.
There was not.
Ms. Shankwell, were you involved in the trial?
Yes.
How long was the trial?
2.5 days.
2.5 days? And how long was the deliberation?
2 hours.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Can I make one more point? How's
okay,
my time?
Sure.
Okay. On the question of could they have come out differently, and here's what Patrick needed to hear from Thomas for Thomas to satisfy his duty of disclosure under the Supreme Court law. And without that, remember, if he doesn't disclose the facts he's required to disclose, the statute doesn't run.
But Mr. Bargiel said that Patrick got the annual statement, and it showed he knew what he got, presumably, and it showed Thomas's. Was there concealment of Thomas's income on the statement? Or?
There was. Thomas admitted that Patrick never knew what he made. He never knew what Sorden or Morse made. This is not a complaint that the officers...
Thomas's compensation is not on the annual statement?
No. First of all, there are officers who weren't overpaid. This is not a complaint that the officers were overpaid at large. It is a complaint
no,
that only three, and that it was If Thomas had said, and this is what he needed to say, Patrick, I don't have a board of directors that operates. I need to tell you this. Nobody approves this comp but me. I decide what I get paid. I decide what these others get paid, and nobody checks up on me. Here's what they get paid. Here are the payments for last year and the year before. By the way, the accountants, I'm sorry I didn't give you these in the past. The accountants have told me they want me to give you these figures. If he does that, then Patrick's in a position where his time starts running. He's got to decide, is there something more I need to ask? Do I need to ask why Mike Sorden was paid four times as much this year than last year? Do I need to ask how many executives there are? Do I need to know how many projects we have going on?
I'm unclear. Mr. Bargill said that every year Patrick would get some kind of financial statement of the company. Is that correct?
Correct.
Pardon?
Correct.
And what would that say, if anything, about Thomas's compensation?
What they argue it says is there's a single line
item. No, it's just a question. What is on the statement?
The answer
it's
is
not a matter of argument.
The answer is nothing.
Nothing about Thomas's compensation.
Correct.
It was executive compensation.
Correct.
And it was a number for all the three executives.
Well, I don't know that there were three, and there's no evidence about how many there were. There may have been four or five. There may have been.
What did discovery show?
There was no discovery of what the word executive meant in that statement.
Well, I mean, didn't pretrial discovery result in figures for compensation?
Well, there are.
I mean, you brought the suit based on what you believe was inappropriate behavior, and the groundswell for that had to be what you found in discovery, Ms. Shoplite.
That's right.
And so what did you find in discovery with regard to the actual numbers?
With regard to the numbers, it was the numbers paid to these three individuals
that
was offensive and that was wrong, especially under the circumstances where it was done arbitrarily and in secret, and deliberately in secret.
No, I understand the what you believe is how it was arrived at. I'm just trying to follow up what Judge Roeder, I thought, was inquiring of. Did you have, at the point of discovery, the number that Thomas was receiving when discovery was closed?
Well, yes, we knew those facts before we even took discovery, once we got the documents from
sure.
the company.
And they came out at trial, right?
The amounts that they were paid, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Shankwala and Mr. Bargill.
Thank you. Thank you, judges.
Case to take my advisement, and the court will be in recess.